And our final speaker today is Emily Marker, who is an assistant professor of European and global history at Rutgers University, Camden. Her work has appeared in French Politics, Culture, and Society, the AHR, and she's currently writing a book on post-World War II efforts to promote solidarity between French and African youth, efforts that collided with a second project, that of making young people in Western Europe feel European, so in the same period. Emily, you may all realize, co-edited recently the H. Salon special issue on race, racism, and the study of France and the Francophone world today. So I will again send you that way, too, after our panel finishes. Thank you, Emily.
So I feel a little far away, but it's okay. So today I want to take you back toward the end of the Second World War, when many European and Franco-Africans begin to imagine a world without racism. They share the conviction that the construction of such a world would require the radical transformation of education, but they differ profoundly in their specific goals, and even in the meaning of race and racism itself. So in this talk, I'm going to juxtapose African and European visions of ending racism through education reform in the post-war conjuncture. Certainly, there's a broad constellation of forces at play in the post-war break, or what Howard Winant refers to as a worldwide crisis of racial formation, that shaped the contours of racial reconstruction in post-war Europe. But my aim today is to argue for the significance of a France-Europe-Africa nexus within that broader constellation, which I suggest helped consolidate a fundamentally new and specifically post-war racial common sense that's really transcending or transecting metropolitan French, colonial African, and transnational European space. So, the man who wrote that blacks are monkeys is dead. This is how Leopold Kaziende remembers feeling upon hearing the news of Hitler's suicide, huddled around a radio with a group of friends and fellow teachers in Niamey in spring 1945. Like many French-educated Africans, Kaziende understood Hitler's death not only as signaling the end of Nazism in Europe, but also as a devastating blow to anti-black racism the world over that would have concrete effects on Africans' everyday lives. Things seemed to look up as a handful of Africans were elected to the Constituent Assembly, charged with drafting a new constitution for what would become the French Union, the Fourth Republic and the French Union, and two newly minted African deputies lent their names to the bills that formally abolished forced labor and the distinction between French citizens and colonial subjects in spring 1946. In his memoir, Kaziende describes how these developments prompted a real change in the way that Francophone Africans, largely low-level functionaries and teachers like himself, carried themselves and expected to be treated by white French in the territories. They would no longer tolerate, and I quote, conspicuously being tutoyed the whole length of the day by their white colleagues. They reacted vigorously to all acts of disrespect in their offices, in the street, in public places, so what we would today call microaggressions, and demanded equal treatment in the colonial bureaucracy and the teaching corps. Kaziende, however, was quick to stress that he and his friends were not provocateurs. They simply considered themselves and white French as equals and were eager for colonial society, and not just the law, to follow suit. On the heels of Allied victory in what so many Africans understood to be an ideological battle against racism, this did not seem too much to expect. Crucially, Kaziende hoped that racial equality would be realized within the framework of a Franco-African community. As recent work by Fred Cooper and others has shown, many Francophone Africans at the close of the war sought decolonization without independence. So to proponents of this other form of decolonization, from local teachers who you've never heard of like Kaziende, to celebrated leaders like Léopold Senghor, legal measures would never be sufficient to achieve these goals. Senghor, who like Kaziende was a teacher by training, believed that decolonizing the empire required both increasing Africans' access to education and inventing a fundamentally new kind of education for Africans. They didn't want a sterile copy or a watered-down version of metropolitan education. African education, Senghor argued, should be rooted in both la civilisation négro-africaine and la francité, to produce an indigenous elite equal to the French. So in contemporary terms, I think that we can characterize Francophone Africans' post-war campaigns for education reform to be really about equity and racial justice. Or to put another way, it was a fundamentally decolonial project to disrupt colonial relations of power. So with each passing year, African politicians, educators, and students used education reform as a benchmark for the decolonization of France-Africa relations more broadly. They campaigned vigorously for the expansion of primary education, the development of secondary education, which was almost non-existent, the creation of African universities, of which there were none, and in the interim, more scholarships for African students to pursue their secondary and post-secondary educations in France. By the end of the 1940s, these issues had become a lightning rod in African efforts to get the French to make good on the promise of an egalitarian French Union. In a rousing speech decrying stalled colonial reform before a gathering of youth leaders in Montpellier in 1949, Congolese teacher Jean Dédé characterized the abysmal education statistics for French Equatorial Africa as a deliberate racial politics on the part of the French to, and I quote, maintain the black man in the animal state. How else, he asked, could one explain that after 6 decades of French rule, in his federation of more than 4 million people, only 5 Africans from AEF obtained the BAC that year? The paucity of schools in France's African territories, he argued, amounted to a politics of illiteracy, while he derided the schools that did exist as mere caricatures, built reluctantly and in bad faith. He did not mince words. The present state of colonial education perpetuated systemic racism in post-war Greater France. So other critics looking elsewhere start focusing on the curriculum itself. Abdourahman Konaté, a youth leader in Dakar in the 1950s, denounced the alienating content in colonial schools. For Konaté, what made this content alienating was not the general cultural deracination so many colonial officials and ethnologists feared, poignantly captured in Kahn's L'Aventure Ambiguë. Rather, for Konaté, it was the curriculum's pronounced anti-African bias, and he singled out history instruction in particular as an instrument of racial domination. He denounced, and I quote, the derisory treatment of ancient African history in the official curriculum, which does its best to paint African chiefs of the resistance as savage and bloody tyrants. Konaté argued that this view of African history produced a racial inferiority complex in African children that helped maintain the colonialist status quo. For this reason, he insisted that curricular reforms were a fundamental prerequisite for the broader cultural, political, and social revolution he and his compatriots sought for French Africa. So taking the views of Senghor, Konaté, Kaziende, and Dédé together, we can see a broad swath of Africans who had firsthand experience with colonial schooling emerge from the war convinced that democratization and decolonization have to begin with education. They sought not just more schools or better schools, but fundamentally different kinds of schools with wholly different objectives. If they were going to decolonize the empire, African education would have to provide young Africans with the cultural confidence to match that of their French peers, so that this would empower young Africans to formulate their own priorities for the development of African societies and Africa's future relations with France. Only this would break the cycle of structural inequality and racial reproduction. So African calls for education reform for equity and racial justice were quite different from the aspirations of Europeans contemplating educational reconstruction across the continent once the war was won. Gathered together in the London-based Conference of Allied Ministers of Education, which I'll refer to by its acronym as CAME, from 1942 to 1945, a transnational group of European political elites, intellectuals, and educators in exile drew up plans for the racial re-education of an entire generation of European youth who had come of age under Nazi occupation. Its members were quick to characterize what they called the Nazi doctrine of man as rubbish, pseudoscientific, and insane. However, their discussions were remarkably abstract. No one explicitly addressed Nazi eugenics, Nazi racial anti-Semitism, the final solution, or Nazi anti-black racism. nor did they consider the extent to which race theory and state racism in Europe were hardly unique to Nazi Germany. So unlike its successor organization, UNESCO, which had an international focus, as you all know, the CAIMS deliberations were conducted primarily by Europeans for Europeans. For Norwegian delegate Alf Sommerfeldt, a prominent linguist who trained and worked in France before the war, the problem was that after so many years of exposure to Nazi race theory, most Europeans, even those in unoccupied lands, were utterly misinformed about what race actually was. Sommerfeldt recounted with dismay how he had recently encountered a British couple who, having adopted an orphaned French infant, began teaching themselves French so that they could communicate with the child when it grew up. He argued that the CAIM could correct such gross misconceptions by developing new pedagogical tools and curricular reforms to Europeanize education and provide young Europeans with what he called the basic facts about race. He listed these as, and I'll quote, the difference between race, language, and nation, an elementary survey of the different anthropological types in Europe and countries of European civilization with a summary treatment of the rest of the world, the problems of the interrelations between civilization and race, and the question of racial superiority. So there could be a lot to unpack there, but I'm just going to focus on the passing remark about the rest of the world, which indicates to Sommerfeldt and other members of the group, their task was not to refute race thinking generally, but rather to correct spurious notions of racial divisions within Europe. Polish, British, French delegates all agreed. They must downplay the principle of race as a significant factor in Europe's past to produce new histories that clearly portrayed Europe as a single civilization. The CAIM was a unique venue where such views converged and flourished, an incubator for an emergent post-war consensus that the diversity of European peoples and cultures was in fact not a question of race at all. So I think, as most people in the room know, this is a significant departure from the elaborate racial frameworks undergirding so much of the political, social, and scientific discourse and policy of the interwar period. One of the CAIM's projects, a new European history textbook that was envisioned to be distributed across the continent after the war, entitled The European Inheritance, A History of European Civilization, is illustrative of this ostensible shift away from race. To be sure, historically racial religious categories like Slavs, Latins, Anglo-Saxons, and Germanics did not disappear from the post-war European lexicon. Indeed, The European Inheritance uses this terminology, but its authors make a special point to dissociate these terms from race. I quote, "Each of these names is linguistic and not a name or term of race. None of them signifies breed or blood or any of the physical facts which are studied by anthropologists." So this racial erasure among Europeans made it possible to celebrate intra-European diversity in a new way, as both a means and a motivation of European integration. This was a major theme for pro-Europe activists in France and elsewhere in Western Europe throughout the late 40s, as a European movement put it in the promotional materials for its first major cultural summit in Lausanne in 1949, where, incidentally, the basic outlines of the Erasmus program and the EUI are both first proposed, the variety and the breadth of Europe's cultural resources could be mobilized to achieve European unity, just as, and I quote, only a united Europe could preserve our cultures in their precious diversity. A few months earlier, the Union of European Federalists, which was more French-led, promoted their first youth congress, proudly declaring, "Europe is a mediating force of 280 million people formed by a common culture and belonging to a single civilization, rich in its diversity and its unity." So despite its veneer of inclusivity, there is an implicit racial oneness in this rhetoric. CAIM delegates, for instance, made a clear distinction between racial misconceptions about Europeans and the issue of race beyond Europe's borders. As Sommerfeldt noted, their proposed reforms will, and I quote, "be of importance not only in combating fascist and Nazi ideas, but also in furthering a more tolerant and comprehending attitude toward people of non-European civilization." He added, with the growing industrialization of Asiatic and African countries and the poisonous effects of Japanese propaganda, it is of the utmost importance to exterminate racial prejudice. So here Sommerfeld doubly externalizes the phenomenon of what he's calling racial prejudice as a fascist and Nazi imposition in Europe and a Japanese export elsewhere, effectively absolving Europe, the good, true Europe, of complicity in the development of modern racism. He also implies that Europe possesses vast moral and intellectual resources that could be mobilized to fight prejudice throughout the world, which not incidentally would provide Europe with a new global vocation, just as colonial empires are seeming to teeter on the brink. Moreover, the de-racing of Europeans, I'm arguing, is infusing that old European, non-European binary with some new content. Rejecting racial categories to differentiate Europeans without disavowing race altogether effectively produced a new boundary between Europeans and non-Europeans, which is race itself. Sommerfeld's suggestion that their reforms would foster a more tolerant and comprehending attitude toward non-Europeans reinforced and renaturalized a racist vision of world order that was then coming under increasing attack. So, of course, it might not be surprising that a transnational group of elite Europeans would insist on the racial unity and equality of Europeans, but only racial tolerance for everyone else. However, this sort of racial re-education was woefully ill-suited to satisfy Francophone African expectations for an egalitarian French Union. Konate, Kaziende, Dade, they were not interested in tolerance or mutual understanding. They demanded equality between whites and blacks, French and Africans, Africans and Europeans, the same equality that groups like the CAIM and later pro-European activists were insisting should be taken for granted to occur naturally among Europeans. So in colonial Africa, meaningful equality required deep structural changes to the whole educational infrastructure of post-war Greater France. In the special circumstances of the post-war conjuncture, French leaders, officials, and educators seemed to acknowledge as much. Facing a new international climate that was at least rhetorically opposed to colonialism and racism, in their own way, they also felt compelled to decolonize education. And they did pursue an array of colonial education reforms in the late 1940s. A plan to overhaul African education was first laid up at the Brazzaville Conference in late 1944 and early 1945. And the following year, billions of francs were allocated for socioeconomic development in the territories, about 8% of which, known as FIDAs, was supposed to go to new school construction and expanding existing capacity in French Africa. So on the one hand, these seem like auspicious developments. And yet by the end of the decade, so already by 1950, French faith in and commitment to colonial education reform had basically evaporated. So what happened? By way of conclusion, I'd like to highlight two ways that I see these competing African and European, say, conceptual repertoires of race and racism became a part of the policymaking process and the process of political negotiation in ways that ultimately limited the scope and effectiveness of colonial education reforms. The first concerns the hardening of that racist binary between a raceless Europe and a re-racialized Africa. From Brazzaville on, reliance on European and European civilization as racial code words became more than a sort of terminological claptrap. Facing the awesomely daunting task of creating a proper system of education to educate millions of Africans after decades of neglect, the widening chasm between Europe and Africa became part of French officials' explanations to themselves about why reform would be so hard, progress so slow, and failure likely. This was especially the case regarding higher education. Indeed, the consensus of Brazzaville was that even metropolitan-style secondary education was for Europeans only. And so educational models would have to be found elsewhere. And so where did they find them? In the Jim Crow South. AEF's Inspector General of Education, Vincent Fournier, cited Booker T. Washington as the inspiration for the renovation of the École des Cadres in Brazzaville in 1946, which was supposed to become the premier institution of higher education for Africans for all of AEF, the entire federation. So the practical education at the new école would focus on developing basic qualities that Fournier said Africans supposedly lack: the ability to think well, physical strength and fortitude, and a strong moral compass. For Fournier, these deficiencies were precisely what made educating Africans uniquely difficult. Such challenges, he argued, were unknown in the metropole and countries of old civilization. This reference was to Europe. In Europe, he continued, each nation has its own school tradition. The culture has deep roots that plunge into the past, whereas in Africa, educators' task was one of wholesale creation. In this estimation, then, Europeans had diverse educational traditions, but they shared a fundamental relationship to the past that ensured an enriching cultural continuity across generations. Africans, on the other hand, not only lacked key personal qualities as individuals, their societies lacked historicity and deep cultural roots. What they did have, as the promotion of a Tuskegee-style education makes clear, was race. Competing conceptions of racism further reinforced that racist logic. While Europeans in venues like the CAME approach racism as a conceptual issue, Francophone Africans saw racism as deeply woven into the social fabric and institutional arrangements of empire. As Europeans advocated for racial erasure for European unity, Francophone Africans' insistence on racial justice struck a particularly discordant note, a constant, unwelcome reminder that Europe's race problem might require more than lexical elision. This tonal clash reanimated an older repertoire of racist stereotypes about Africans as presumptuous, demagogic, and irrational, which, in a kind of pernicious feedback loop, further strengthened the conviction that Africans were naturally unfit for advanced study. Fournier, for instance, endorsed practical education to avoid producing what he called overeducated Africans, who he described as those monsters that carry around overly ambitious brains atop restless and malnourished bodies. Perhaps this is how he would have characterized Jean Dadé, an educated African from his federation, railing on about the administration's racist politics of illiteracy. But even sympathetic French observers felt provoked by such rhetoric. Jean Capel, who served as head of education in AOF in the late 1940s, and who Senghor really did consider an ally in the struggle for the decolonization of education, derisively recalls how Africans, and I quote, accused us of a Machiavellian plot to reestablish a system based on racial discrimination. This construes Africans' positions as paranoid and delusional, even though Capel's own experience battling a recalcitrant colonial authority for 4 long years, which culminated in his resignation in protest, suggests quite the contrary. So rather than associate Africans' critiques with his own palpable frustration over stalled reform, Capel attributed this to Francophone Africans, and I quote, damaging feelings of inferiority, which gives rise to expressions of vanity, irritability, and vicious criticisms of Europeans. In so doing, Capel essentially construes that criticism, or reduces it to, a form of prejudice rather than a legitimate political grievance. This logic resonated widely in the ranks of colonial officials in both colony and metropole. Indeed, it is precisely in this period that we find the first instances of the most vocal Francophone African activists, politicians, and students being accused of anti-white racism. This proved a powerful and enduring rhetorical strategy to dismiss specific African demands for curricular reforms and access to education. The ease with which these foundational demands for a decent education could be dispensed with by invoking anti-white racism, while simultaneously deepening a racist Europe-Africa binary, became a key part of what I'm calling post-war racial common sense.